Welcome to Radio Rehab. I'm your host, Dana, and I'm an addict and alcoholic. If this is your first time tuning into the show, let me just tell you that we have over 300 episodes in the bank. We are a show by an addict alcoholic for addicts and alcoholics and their families. Tons of stuff for you to go back and listen to. I am so excited about this episode because I am welcoming back to the show friend of Radio Rehab, Vicki Lucas, who is the head of Equanimity Interventions, and new friend of the show, Brandon Novak. I don't know, perhaps you've heard of him. Let him tell you about his own story. Let's join the conversation.
Welcome to Radio Rehab. Here's your host, Dana Keyes.
Welcome, guys.
Thank you for having me. This is my first time. You're breaking my virginity, so please be gentle with me.
I'm always very gentle. At least I try to be. And if I'm not, you don't have to answer my questions.
Fair play.
Since this is your first time on the show, can we get a little background on you?
Yeah. Fuck, man. I'm a man that's worn like many hats throughout my careers, I guess, plural. I'm a former professional skateboarder. After that, I ended up in these movies, Jackass, and TV shows, Viva La Bam, and then after that, I went to write a New York Times top 10 selling autobiography addiction memoir about my life, titled Dream Seller. In theory and on paper, I had did some things in life that people would equate to success or happiness that some may even dream of doing, but in reality, what my life really looked like is I was 35 years old. I had just woken up from being on life support for 7 days. I was walking into my 13th inpatient treatment center. I had lost count of outpatients and detoxes. My mother had bought me a plot. People had taken life insurance policies out on me. I had been medevaced to 4 different states, from 4 different overdoses to 4 different hospitals. I found myself at 35 years old, a homeless heroin addict who stood on the corner of Eastern Avenue and Patterson Park in Baltimore City, prostituting my body just to get another bag. My mother had sold 3 homes to financially pay for me to go to 2 different treatment centers. At the end of my run, when she had nothing left to give, she simply went to God with 1 prayer, and that prayer consisted of, God, please cure him, please kill him, or please kill me because I can't take it anymore. And today I come to you, to your lovely podcast, as a man who's getting ready to celebrate 5 years of continuous sobriety, May 25th.
Right on. That's awesome. Yay. That is so cool.
I'm on that.
Super similar to my story, just different city.
Sure.
And I'm about like 4 or 5 months behind you in sobriety. So
yeah, that's right. You know, that's the thing I say to people often is, you know, the stories generally are the same, minus specifics here and there. The only thing that really differs is our name.
Mm-hmm. I know. It's like that, and then that's one thing about recovery where it's like you can just go to not be judged. Except like, because I was telling a story in a meeting the other day, and we were talking about like, how are we addicts not immune to coronavirus after the nasty stuff we've done? And, you know, I was like, yeah. And I was just remembering a time, like I shot up with toilet water from a Taco Bell bathroom in East LA, you know?
Absolutely.
And yeah, normally you do. Like, I saw that story and like, people are like, ew.
Yeah.
You know, if you tell it to people who get it, then it's like, you know, they get it.
Yeah. We get to that point in our career, if you will, of addiction or alcoholism, where the abnormal becomes the normal. We're living at that animalistic level where we merely live to use and use to live. I remember one time I was too, if we're going to go quickly on those stories, I stole someone's, they went out to cop and they wouldn't give me any dope, and they left their cookers and their spoons and needles there. So I was hurrying up to try to steal a cotton shop from them.
Right.
But I didn't have my own needle. I was taking hers. So I had a thing of bleach and a thing of water, and I was hurrying up and I was rushing the water to get the shot, but I was rushing the bleach out to kill the disease on the needle. And I was in such a hurry, I put the bleach into the cotton shot and I cooked it up and it came back really yellow. And I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm about to get like a really good shot.
Oh no.
Shot bleach. And despite knowing what I was doing, right, the power of addiction, I couldn't stop myself because there could have been a chance that there was some dope in there.
Just enough to make you well. Yeah, exactly. And I always tell people that I'm like, it's not like we're doing it to party. It's like we're doing it so we can get in the shower. Like you're doing it so you don't hurt.
Literally. I was doing methamphetamine, so none of that was happening for me.
Really?
Yeah. You were just shooting meth hanging on a beach, very similar to
Didn't
today.
Even shoot it. Smoked it. Drank it. Ate it.
Was it organic?
No, it's funny how people think, because I was just thinking about, I went to a hotel room to help out a friend, and she was shooting meth in the bathroom, and I was starving, so I ordered a Big Mac, because I'm a fat dyke, so I get a Big Mac, and I'm sitting there eating it, and she walks out of the bathroom, and I knew she was shooting dope in there, and she goes, why do you eat that shit? I can't believe you're eating a Big Mac. And I was like, bitch, you just stuck meth in your vein and you're worried about my Big Mac? Shut up.
I know, that was like the River Phoenix story. It's like he would cry if somebody he was with even ate fish, you know, but meanwhile, like he's mainlining heroin.
I can remember, I used to be the guy that would do the shot of dope in the bathroom with the water out of the toilet. And like immediately after, I would go do a shot of wheatgrass.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, like true story.
That is, so I know. I remember like towards the end of one of my runs anyway, when I was drinking a lot, being on the elliptical trainer with like one of those water bottles with vodka in it. Like, what am I doing? Like this will get it out of my system.
Yeah,
exactly. Still trying to be healthy. So at what point did you decide that you wanted to start helping other people?
I got to a point where like, you know, pain, like I'm not clever enough to paint myself in this picture for which you see me in today, mm-hmm. right? Left to my own devices. I'll finish this. I'll go around the way. I'll cop some dope. And the scary thing is that I can make it complete sense to me. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't take credit for where I'm at today. All I merely did was reacted to enough pain. Right. I'm not the kind of guy that changes when shit's unmanageable. I change when shit's unfucking bearable.
Yeah.
So pain had finally become great enough that I had was overcome with this sense of willingness, unlike anything I knew that existed, which was clearly delivered to me by a power greater than myself, right? No human power could ever get or keep me sober. So I finally had that spiritual experience of that higher power that did for me what no human power could, which was lift me of the obsession or rid me of the desire to want to like shoot dope. And finally walking into that 13th facility, you know, because people often ask me, what was different from number 13 to number 8 to number 2 to number 1? Really fucking nothing, right? The same information was being given, and I was retaining bits and pieces. The only thing different was that the pain had become great enough that I walked into that facility, you know, a 35-year-old homeless heroin addict who wanted to kill himself on a daily basis. I just didn't want to hurt myself in the process anymore. I was horrible at suicide because I kept waking up and I was at a position in life where I was so low the curb looked like a skyscraper. And I walked in and I came to the grand realization, right, that you know what I do know is that I don't fucking know. And the very best of my thinking places me in positions like this time after time after time. I don't know, but clearly like they do because they seem to be here and sober every time I come begging for help yet again. So I don't know. You do. Can you help me? I put my hand out and I became open-minded and willing to follow their suggestions. And ultimately, it just snowballed into the here and now. For the first time, I walked into treatment with absolutely no plan. And that lack of plan has produced the best of plans because it simply allowed me to get the fuck out of my own way. Right? I'm the problem. The heroin's merely the solution. I didn't understand that at the time, but because of the willingness that was a direct result of all the pain that I endured, and the heroin stopped working, right? Like you talked about, just shooting enough to get up and get out of bed and brush my teeth to get another bag. I was willing to follow any suggestions that you guys gave me, right? So people like Vicky with like long-term recovery and sobriety, they'd say, okay, if you change your perception, you can change your world. And your defects can become your assets with a shift of perception. So with that being said, I finally get sober. I stay sober and I start like, people ask me to speak and talk around, you know, conventions, rallies, things. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing people, right? What I've come to understand is that addicts and alcoholics, when I put my hand up and I say I'm an alcoholic, all it means is that I'm defiant by nature. I hate authority and I'll never conform. And was my idea, because I possess that job that consists of knowing everything. So thank you, Vicky, for telling me what I need to do. But Vicky, you need to fuck off, because I know, right? And the scary thing is my resume states that I know some shit because I did some things in life, right, that would equate to success. But upon walking in there and the pain becoming so great, following your suggestions, I experienced those 12 steps, had that spiritual experience. And now I use this platform that I had prior to sobriety to simply deliver my message in a form of attraction rather than promotion. I make it look really appealing and desirable. I like to think that someone would want to fuck it, right? That's how because what happens is that the defiant addict and alcoholic that will never change unless it becomes their idea, all of a sudden they see this life that I'm living that might look pretty fucking rad. And they're like, if that guy can do it, whose message holds depth and weight, right? I can read it in the books. I can see it on tabloids. I can look at it in the magazines, the internet, everywhere. If he can do it, there's no reason why I can't. Can you help me, right? The same experience I felt walking to that 13th facility. And then something, the whole term of their contract changes at that very moment because it now becomes our idea. And as you know, as all of us here know, when it becomes our idea, we excel at a rapid fucking pace. Mm-hmm. It has to be our idea.
Right. So, the gift of desperation.
The very long fucking winded answer to your very short question, because I love my fucking voice, is that I just knew that, like, my message held depth and weight, and when I shared it with people in the fashion that I do, they can relate. And it's just a sleight of hand, smoking mirrors kind of fucking deal. And I present the same message that's been presented for years, just in a different box or wrapper.
Right. I have similar story like we were just talking about. It's like, I think 14 rehabs, and people are always like, what was different about the last one? I'm like, nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. It was pretty much the same as all the other ones. Just I was different.
The doe and the cows, and you didn't know where you were.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Vicky dropped me off somewhere, I'll tell you what. In the middle of nowhere.
She was shit-faced.
Oh, my God.
She should be.
I was on everything. I know. When they did our test at the end, they were like, hey, let's look at, like, what was in your system when you came in here. I'm like, do we have to? Really? And, like, it's been 2 weeks. I'm fine. I'm like, no, this is bad. There's nothing you weren't on. Well, you know, it was a long ride up here. I don't know. What can I tell you?
And I don't have blue teeth, but my background is doing something here.
I like this because you've got equanimity interventions in the background and it's blue and your teeth are blue. It actually looks kind of cool. We've been doing a lot of Zoom recovery meetings and I had like a background of the Golden Gate Bridge and it looked so cheesy and I thought it was funny, but my sponsor was like, you're being disruptive. I'm like, ow.
What else is new?
I know. Exactly.
Not much has changed since the day you dropped her off in the middle of the woods, Vicky.
Exactly. Like, good thing she's not actually at normal meetings with me because I'm totally like laughing on the back end. But I'm like a 4-year-old. I mean, really. But so, Vicky, you last time we talked to you, you had just started your company. Like, I don't want to ask, you know, do you guys talk about anything you don't want to talk about, obviously, because I know, you know, business things can be secret sometimes. But like, what are you doing right now with your intervention company?
Well, right now, because of the coronavirus, like, I've gotten busy. I'm busier than I was before coronavirus. Well, because what's happening is mental health is escalating and I'm doing a lot of crisis interventions and people doing methamphetamines cannot be in the house with their parents. Like, it's not working out well.
Yeah.
I'm getting a lot of calls with that. But what I'm doing is I've dropped my prices a lot because people are scared to spend money right now. Everybody's in financial crisis. So I'm doing a lot of interventions for a low amount of money, but we're getting people into treatment still, which is amazing. And Brandon and I do interventions together, which is great. I mean, we did an intervention together in San Francisco where we didn't even have to talk to the guy. He was just so stoked that Brandon Novak was in his living room. It was already sold. He didn't even want to get out of bed till I said, look, your whole family's here in the living room. And he's like, great. I go, do you know what this is? He goes, yeah. I go, you feel awkward? He goes, yeah. And he just kept going, fuck, fuck. I'm all, well, the good news is Brandon Novak's doing your intervention with me and he's in your living room. And he goes, no fucking way. And he was out of bed just like that in the living room. We talked to him for what? 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
And he's still sober too, right?
Huh?
He's still sober too, right?
Yeah. So
Yeah, well, that's got to be cool when there's success stories like that and it works.
Oh yeah. So right now I'm just, doing a lot of interventions, a lot of transports. People don't want to fly. And Brandon and I are we're working on some stuff to help the underprivileged people that can't always get into great treatment facilities or people that need interventions and the families can't afford them. So
how did you guys meet? Like, when did you guys start working together?
Well, I met Vicky through her very good friend and my newfound good friend, Cherie. Cherie owns a facility out there, and she had brought me out to speak at her facility and kind of opened it up to like a networking event, if you will. And the one and only, Vicky, graced us with her presence that day. And immediately we hit it off, you know, like we're very similar in a lot of ways, and very different in a few, very small few ways.
Right.
So with that being said, I had just completed my training to become a certified interventionist with the CIP certification. And it's, she does them. She's in the same group as myself. And the reality is like Vicky's out there. She's West Coast. I live in Philadelphia. I don't really have any ties or too much of a stronghold there. She does. And I come out there often enough to where she's like, you know, maybe we could collaborate and do some things together. And I'm all about, you know, because I was that guy that was deemed unhelpable and unfixable. And I believe that I was placed in this position that I'm at today solely by the God of my understanding, because all rights do, I should have been dead years ago. And I believe I was brought through that to simply allow people to know that, like, there is a way up and out of your position, provided you just get the fuck out of your way. I can't give you legal advice. I can't tell you how to perform brain surgery, but the one thing I can fucking tell you through and through is addiction and alcoholism.
Yeah.
I'm into that game. That's the game that I know. And I'm great at playing devil's advocate, because there's not much I haven't seen, tried, or did to get another one. Uh-huh. There's not much I haven't seen, tried, or did to get sober. So it makes complete sense to me why a lot of times they prefer to continue in active addiction as opposed to take my or Vicky's offer for a new way of life. You know, I get it. It makes sense. It's the language that I speak. Again, going back to where you started, you know, with these meetings and us collectively and the Zoom meetings, I believe it's just a big group of misfits that actually fit for once.
Mm-hmm.
And we speak that language, you know?
Yeah.
So with that being said, Vicky and I just had that, you know, you just get that instant connection with somebody and it seems really natural, organic, if you will. We have that. We had that immediately. And she's out there. We have a facility that just opened out there. I'm back and forth a lot. Whenever she sees something that makes sense to bring me in on it, absolutely. Vice versa here. You know, she was planning on flying in to see me and my facilities that I work with in Florida, but because of the coronavirus, that kind of abruptly came to a halt. But we'll reconnect with that again. But she just knows the lay of the land. You know what I mean? She's been sober. She's been clean a long time. She's been in the business a long time. And she just kind of allowed me to fucking ride her coattail for a little bit in the intervention world, because that's an area. I'm really good at doing them. I just don't know how to – I don't network well. I don't play well with others, right? Mm-hmm. Unless I like you, I don't really fucking care to like you. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah, totally.
I like everybody. I work well with, you know, beautiful women.
So you do get along with everybody, though, pretty much, Vicky. Or at least you're good at acting like you do. You do. You totally do. You might hate them later and be like, I hated that guy. But, like, not – definitely not obvious.
Hey, yeah. You know what? The wonderful thing about recovery is we don't have to like you to help you. Like, yeah. I still want everybody to be clean, no matter what my opinion is of them. Like, everybody deserves this chance, this opportunity. And then guess what? They usually become somebody that we do like. They like us. We like them. But it's really hard sometimes. I have to remind myself all the time when I'm dealing with the insanity that was my insanity for a long time. Like, I see these parents just, they're calling me all the time and their wheels are spinning. Imagine what my parents were doing. I mean, there weren't interventionists. There weren't access to a bunch of treatment facilities. It's just, you know, I'm coming up on 23 years. I've been around here for a minute.
Yeah.
So, there's just, it wasn't like it is now. That just wasn't going on. So my parents fucking moved, rented out the house and moved for a while because they got sick of me showing up and they didn't know how to deal with it. They're just like, later.
God. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, I've heard stories like that before. It always makes me think of Eddie Murphy. That one thing he says, suck a dick and relocate. I feel like I don't have kids, and I feel like if I did, I would know what to do. I feel like I would leave my house too and be like, I can't. I just don't know.
My mother threatened me with that many a days. Like when I go there and just like refuse to leave and demand money and until I got it, and she'd be like, I swear to God, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to sell this house. I'm going to completely relocate, and I will never tell you where I'm going.
Wow.
Well, I'm an interventionist, and I couldn't kick my own kid out, you know? And then when I finally did it, guess where he is? He's in treatment right now.
Right. Is it harder? Well, I mean, that's an interesting topic. Is it harder? Obviously, it's harder with your own kid.
I'm emotionally attached to him. It's totally... I have all the fear everybody else does, and if I let him go out there, he's going to die or something. Like, I have these visions of, he's so beautiful. I have like, oh my God, some guy is going to do something to him. Or, well, you know him, Dana.
I know
him well. He's a great looking kid and he's not a big guy. He's little. So somebody's going to fuck him up and then I'm going to have to go kick their mom's ass. Or, you know, like, I am a mama bear with my kids and it was hard. It was hard to tell him like, nah, I can't do this anymore. But it was the best thing I did for him. It took him like, you know, he's got such great hustle. I think it lasted like 3 days. Okay, Mom, I'm ready to go.
Aww.
And, but you know, it's great. I can relate to parents like that, you know, like, you know what? I understand, but I did it. It only took my kid a few days. And I promise if you stick to this, it's not going to take long, you know?
Right.
Even if you fake it, you know?
Like the tough love thing that you got to get out.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be, you know, every situation is different. If there's somebody with suicidal ideation or any of that kind of stuff is going on, I'm not going to suggest that.
Right.
Yeah, I don't want to be the one that, oh my God, you told us to kick our kid out and now he's dead. Or now she's dead. So it's got to be a mutual agreement with the family, but it's not always the only way. Like there's no, the way I work, every interventionist is different. The way I work, I don't believe in a cookie cutter intervention. I don't believe that they're all the same. Family dynamics, everything's different. People are different. There's parents that are never going to kick their kids out of the house, or husbands that aren't going to kick their wives out, or vice versa. And there's some that you, before you even start the intervention, they're like, I already got a bag pack. They're going to treatment or they're out, you know?
Yeah.
So everybody's different and there's always an answer. And if you're willing to work with the families long enough, even if they don't go on the first time, you'll get it. They'll go. They'll go eventually. But, you know, sometimes you have to do more of an intervention on the family than you do on the actual client because the family's so codependent, you can't get anywhere.
Yeah, I didn't think
it's,
that.
It's just a whole big thing, but it ends up usually being a big, beautiful thing. And what it comes down to is saving lives, because that's absolutely what you're doing. When you get somebody into treatment in the hopes that they get it and they get clean or sober, whatever you want to call it, they make life changes, they have a chance to live. If they don't do that, it's not long. They're not that far away from dying.
Right. What's the biggest obstacle, like, for when you do an intervention? What are the biggest obstacles that happen that make your job, like, the hardest?
The families.
Oh.
I recently just had a family, and Vicky's 100% right. This is my experience. A lot of times, unfortunately, the family's sicker than the actual individual that we're going to help. And this family contacted me, and I went and performed the intervention, a successful intervention, right? And then I'm going to send the kid to a facility. And then they hired me to be his sober companion and actually fly with him to the facility I was sending him to. Did all that. 4 days later, the mother caved and bought him a flight right back home. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, father stood firm, mother caved, and then just couldn't understand why they're right back where we left off.
Oh, my God. So they have to basically start over with the whole thing.
Yeah.
Did they get it after that?
No, not. So what they did was they rewarded his behaviors by still pursuing their family vacation to Mexico.
Oh, wow.
So after he went to treatment and stayed for 4 days and left AMA against medical advice, they rewarded those behaviors with the family vacation, all collectively, including him going to Mexico.
Oh. Right. I had a kid back east that took DMT and never came out of it. Like stayed in this whole world that was just burning his tongue with cigars and he really believed that the biggest favor you could do for somebody is kill somebody. So I'm driving with this kid and a family member from back east out to San Diego to get him into some stabilization treatment before he went anywhere else. And you know, we get across a few states and we have to have him committed. And it was bad and it was sad. I mean, this is a sweet, good looking kid that just snapped. And he's in this psych ward for quite some time. And we're going to get him from the psych ward to the next facility. Well, mom decides he can come home. He talks to parents into letting them come home for a while first. Tells them the meds are making him tired, off the meds, and the psychosis starts again. You know, and so that is a big roadblock, like families and the codependency. I mean, if you're a good interventionist, you're going to work with the families to keep that at bay and to keep their boundaries intact, because just like a little kid craves a house with structure, with a bedtime, a feeding time, homework time, and they excel in that environment, addicts need the same thing. So families need the same thing. So you gotta make sure that the families, you have to help them set a boundary that they can deal with and then help them stick with those boundaries throughout the process. I mean, your job isn't over when they go into treatment. You gotta keep on it and try to continue to help the family keep their boundaries. But if they don't, like Brandon said, they unravel, the family will unravel the whole thing, and you know, there's not much we can do until they call us back.
You brought up a really good point, Vicky, like, you know, how families, children, mm-hmm. people in recovery, I think we can all agree, we thrive when we're in somewhat of a controlled environment, right? Mm-hmm. Like a structured environment. Mm-hmm. And now I think, you know, going back to you saying how busy you are, because and the way that we're meeting is not a controlled, structured environment that alcoholics and addicts are treated, right? Like, yeah. This is completely out of the norm for anybody. And I think that even people in recovery, it's hard at times, depending on who they are, for whatever their reason is. But then the people that are using anyways, right? So these services that you're providing, that I'm providing, that we're doing collectively as a whole, you are with this podcast is fucking imperative. Right?
Yeah. Because
the opposite of addiction is connection. But then you have the government saying, okay, you need to practice social distancing and quarantining, right? Like staying away from everybody. Fuck, how do we adapt in that?
Yeah. I know. It's like affecting me. I know people like through groups that have like just gotten clean and sober and they're like going, calling me and going like, how do I do this? And I'm like, I don't even know. Like, yeah. I really don't know. Like, you know, I'm back to like having kind of no structure, you know, less work to do. And it's like it takes work to stay sober. Like I gotta get up and make myself do something, you know, like I gotta make myself exercise. I gotta make myself. Yeah, exactly. Because I would have done anything for the drugs back then. You know what I mean? Like, But yeah, but it's like, it's just too much time on our hands, I feel like, can be dangerous.
Always.
Yeah.
I'm going back to what you guys were saying. I'm like a real creature of habit. I'm a real structured individual. I'm the complete opposite than I used to be, right? Mm. Completely in every way, shape, and form opposite. And now everything has a place, position, a time, and that whole psychic change is taking place. And now with this, right, I started like going to bed later, waking up later, no structure, no organization, no routine. And I did not change. And I fucking hate internet. I'm not internet, but I hate technology. This is the first, at a 43-year-old man, this is the first laptop I've ever owned. And it's only because my employer said, you have to have this. We're going to send it to you set up because like the sign of the times.
Right.
I'm furious. I don't know how to, I don't email. I have an assistant that kind of does a lot of shit, so it keeps me stupid. I don't learn, but I don't email. I don't do the Zoom. And again, when my back was against the wall and the pain had become great enough, like I remember started waking up in the morning wishing that this was all a horrible nightmare. I'm like, I have to figure this out, right? Because it's all my perspective and perception. So I reverted back to when I had the opportunity to be incarcerated for an extended period of time. And I was like, okay, I need to implement a routine. I need to like carve out my day with how it looks like, because this whole fucking aimlessly strolling around my place with no real direction is going to drive me fucking mad. So I had to start setting in like controlled media consumption, accept things exactly as they are, stop putting expectations on where I believe they should be. And really just you people, again, it all comes back to my recovery and sobriety. People like Vicky with 23 years told me in the beginning, there's going to come a point in time when your back's against the wall and you're not going to have anyone to turn to but the God of your understanding. So like this has brought me closer to my God of my understanding. You know, I choose to see this as us merely being divinely inconvenienced. What I've learned is my life is lived forward and learned backwards. And that day when I walked into treatment, May 25th, 2015, there's no word in the English dictionary that could properly suffice to how fucked I felt. You add the word less to everything, and that's what I felt that day. It was the scariest day and event of my life walking in. And little did I know that that day was going to turn out to be the best day of my life. But I was incapable of seeing it because I was so consumed by the fucking problem. I wasn't even close to finding the solution.
Right.
So now, knowing what I know, having that heightened sense of awareness through experiencing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that this is merely a bump in the road. It's fucking temporary at best. So I'm embracing it. I'm taking it in and I'm learning a lot about myself. And a lot of growth is happening depending upon how I perceive it.
Yes. A friend of mine was saying the same thing. He was talking about how when he used to be in treatment, he would feel like, you know, I can't wait to get out and start my life, you know, and like that. And then there was no life. Like life is what you make it. Life is what's happening. This is life. You know, yes, this is reality, you know? And that's, I think why I went, that's why I was in, I don't remember if it was 14 or 15, but that's why I was in so many treatment centers. So I would get out and I would just go back to my life, which was nothing. I woke up whenever I felt like it. I had nothing to do. You know what I mean? Like I just had no structure. It's always been really hard for me to structure myself. So like, yeah, this is a new normal, but I feel like I'm going to be a different person when we come out of this. Like I'm totally just, I think I'm going to be stronger.
Do you think you'll be a lesbian?
I don't know. I have no idea. You know, it depends on what I run out of to watch on Netflix and what ends up, you know, what I end up watching.
The L Word is really good. You should watch The L Word.
Hey.
Let me recommend some shows for you.
Okay, yes, definitely, right. Yeah.
It's like my dyke version of my spirit animal.
I know. Like, why is Vicky sending me Pornhub links? What is this? I thought I was going to a meeting.
Clearly, why is Vicky not sending me Pornhub links?
But you know, they keep coming back because it works. That's all I can say.
You know, I think it's funny that, because I think there's this misconception, at least that I had, that an intervention was done once you got into treatment. Like, I know, Vicky, you still stayed in contact with my family. That's because you know my family. I didn't think that was something that an interventionist does, like that she or he would, you know, that they, that it continues way after they get into treatment. Because people,
it's not,
keep doing
it
something.
Might not be what all interventionists do. It's what we do.
Okay.
You know, I stay in contract with my clients for 6 months. So they don't have to pay me over and over and over again.
Right.
6 months, if I have to travel, they'll pay for that. But in that 6 months, if the intervention doesn't work the first time, I'm going to go back, or I'm going to stay on the phone. I'm going to continue to have this rapport in this relationship until I can get them into treatment. It also includes being there to coach the parents through things. If they try to leave against medical advice, I'm going to be on the phone with the treatment facility. I'm going to be on the phone saying, hey, you know, let's talk about these boundaries. What's going to be the consequence of you leaving treatment? If that facility doesn't work, like let's say I got one today, I put him in a treatment facility a few days ago, a week ago, and his psychosis just isn't leveling out from the methamphetamine. So they put him, they 5150'd him, and now I'm helping them plan the next place that he goes to because he needs to be stabilized for a while. And then I'll follow through to make sure he gets back to the original treatment facility. I'm the first person that patient or client is deciding to trust. So I need to be there for them through the process.
To show them this works.
Right. And I'm not bound to any facility or any ethics where, oh, we can't talk for 2 years after. I'm not bound to that stuff like treatment facilities.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm totally down. If somebody comes out of treatment and they're in my area, they want to go to a meeting with me, let's go. When I go into Zoom meetings and I speak, like I did the other day, there were clients of mine in that meeting. You know, like I'm okay with all of that. And I just, like when I say I want people to get clean and stay clean, like you already know, I mean it.
I know. I know. I can say that from experience. I know. Because I remember that one treatment center that you got me into where I wanted to leave the minute I realized that I was going to have to be there for more than 3 days. Because that's all I needed.
I remember calling you going, Grammy paid for this already, Dana. Oh, you ain't going nowhere.
No. God, that's my weakness. Bring Grammy into it. I'll be like, okay. She passed away a couple months ago. I'm really glad she lived to see me get clean. You know, I'm glad that her last memory is of me now and not the way I used to be, because that would have broken my heart. Like she's, yeah, you know, my earth angel. I loved her. So yeah, like that really meant a lot to me to be able to do that, you know. And
she was awesome.
I know. It's like I look back at, it's so funny because like out of all my amends, hers was the hardest. And it's like, I didn't do the stuff to her that I did to my mom. I did awful stuff to my parents and to people I know. And to Grammy, like my amends was really just like, I'm sorry for making you worry about me. And I was just sobbing. It was like I was like, why is this hard? You know, it's like, there's other ones where it's like, I'm sorry for registering you as a sex offender. I thought it was funny. You know, it's like, that was easy. Like, but then the Grammy one, I'm like, oh my God, Grammy. You know, I'm really glad.
What? I love that one.
I'm still there too. Fucking brilliant.
I don't think I can hear another thing after that.
I agree. I'm still there.
You guys are my people.
We are. That's clearly why we travel together.
Oh my God, I know. I mean, we would burn shit up. It would be bad.
People would not want us in their cities.
That's the rad thing that, like, when Vicky and I did that intervention together, and when we kind of come together for work in any reason or capacity, you know, it's very clear to see that not only do we love what we do, we're just really happy people. And that's solely and directly as a result of being clean and sober, right? So that kind of just radiates and people see that. And we don't, you know, we're not the people that come in and say, well, Janet, your father says you need rehab and we're going to take you to rehab. You know, we yeah, fucking get it. We make them laugh. We joke. We play. We you know, we show them that, like, the severity of it, but also the reality of how fucking retarded they look at that moment in time and
right,
what life could be. And the cool thing is that we love it so much is that we're willing to, like, you know, it's not black and white, one size fits all. Like, all right, the family comes and they're in a position where they can only, you know, afford this much or do this. Like, I know Vicky does it. I will do it. We didn't get into this to make $1 million and fucking retire. We got into it, I believe, because we love it. And it's the language mm-hmm. we speak. And we genuinely give a fuck.
Yeah. And
it's
people,
absolutely what I'm supposed to be doing, 100%.
Yeah. You found your calling. You both did. Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome. That's really cool. Like, I'm glad to be a part of it today, and I'm glad I can help spread this message because I think it's super important. You know, I was talking to my mom, and I was talking about, she was asking me when I was going to record today on the phone, and I was telling her, and she goes, are interventions still happening right now? I'm like, Mom, like, you think drugs stopped? Like, you think there's like a shelter in place order, and addicts went, oh, yeah, okay, we can't go out. No.
I love your mom.
I know.
And her little Mississippi accent.
I know. And that was the other funny thing. She's going to hate that I told the story about it. She's like, who else is on with Vicky? And I said, his name is Brandon. He's a skater. She went, an ice skater? Like, yes, Mom, a famous ice skater and Vicky are going to be on the show.
That's great.
He's this really flamboyant ice skater.
You'd love that.
I know. You'd be dressed in the whole ice skating outfit.
I already put a mental picture together of me swirling on the ice.
Yes. Or next time you're out skateboarding, you should wear an ice skating outfit. I think that would be brilliant. That would love, and definitely film it.
So you want to hear a favorite intervention story?
Yes.
So I'll just do this one real quick, and then maybe Brandon will have time for one or something. So I don't think I did this, talked about this one on your show last, but I went up to Grass Valley in the middle of nowhere doing an intervention on this guy. And actually, he was in Nevada City at the time. Cute little old mom. And he was on methamphetamine. He had just been arrested the night before with a sawed-off shotgun in a hotel because he thought that a flying saucer, a UFO, landed on their property. And he was trying to protect everybody. So he traded his bike for a sawed-off shotgun and got caught and got arrested and got OR'd. Which I don't know, how do you get OR'd with a sawed-off shotgun?
That's
anyways.
A good trade, a bike for a shotgun?
I know.
That's a good trade. So, I go to do the intervention and I have all the family together at a conference room in a hotel and we call the girlfriend and he's taken off. They get in a fight and he's not there. So I'm in this brand new black Mercedes and I pull up to the house and the house is just like, you know, they're hoarding so much they've now moved it into the front yard. Okay. Yeah. And I talked to the girlfriend and she said he went hitchhiking. He's probably on 49, which is a road between Nevada City and Grass Valley. And you know, I already saw him on Facebook, so I already knew what he looked like. And I'm driving down 49. I come up to a stop sign and out pops this guy, pouring in sweat, bald head. He's got a backpack with all these like trinkets on it. And I'm like, there's my guy. So I roll down my window. I go, hey, you want a ride? And he goes, yeah. And I go, all right, get in, but you got to sit in the back seat. And he goes, you're going to let me in your Mercedes? And I go, yeah, get in the back seat. So he gets in the back seat and he sits in and I'm watching him through the rear view mirror, you know, and he goes, boy, I can't believe you picked me up. Today must be my lucky day. And I go, you have no idea. So I proceed to do the intervention on him on the way back to the hotel and tell him who I am and what I'm doing. He just falls back in the seat and melts and starts crying with like relief. And he says, you know, when I was in jail last night, there was this guy and the color of his eyes kept changing. He was trying to help me. And I've seen the color of your eyes change. You're him, huh? You shifted. I'm all, yeah.
Yeah. Sure. That's what you need to hear. Yes.
I'm watching him through the rearview mirror and he goes, do you know about the Illuminati, Vicky? And I said, I don't know what you're talking about, bro. And he goes, you know. Oh, that's right. So yeah, went to the hotel, took him in, told the family he's going to treatment. Can we read the letters? Nope, just give them to me. And he goes, well, I need to go back to my trailer. No, you ain't going nowhere, bro. I got money. We'll go to Target or something, buy you some clothes. We're out. But and he's changed so much. Like the whole process, he's he's going to be in and out of treatment for probably a very long time, but the psychosis is part of it. But that's probably my favorite, one of my favorite intervention stories.
That is so good.
I love the craziness. I can't help it.
I love hearing that. I absolutely love hearing that. Brandon, do you have time for one story?
Yeah. I remember it was in Baltimore, right? In my mind, it should have been an easy layup. The kid was a big fan of mine. He was a skater. He was from my hometown. Family reached out to me, so I went there and spent 2 or 3 days with the family, like getting everyone, you know, on a unified front and really collectively coming together as one. And then the fourth day, I meet the kid and his girlfriend, and we go out dinner, and I like Vicky said, I'm pretty unconventional. Like mine aren't the same, the interventions that it just depends upon the chemistry I have with the person, and there's a lot that goes into it. But with this kid, him and his girlfriend came out. Girlfriend was pro him getting help, so she wasn't a deterrent. And by the end of the dinner, the kid agreed to go, right? So I'm like, fuck yeah, this is good. And we went back. He stayed with me that night. We were on the next flight out in the morning. And we go to BWI Airport. And I take him in. We go through, and I'm actually flying with him as well. And as we get to the gate, I can see him literally being consumed by his addiction, right? Because reality is setting in for what's about to happen. He's about to board a flight from Baltimore to a completely different state and to get clean, and his addiction's not fucking happy. And he's literally left and right coming to me with excuse after excuse, and I have two phones, and each excuse he gives me, I'm completely fucking putting it down, and I'm taking care of it. Bang, bang, bang. And then the woman looks over and she said, sir, if you're boarding the flight, this is it. You have to come now or the door's shutting. And within me turning back around to look at him, he grabs his bag and he runs out of the airport. And I felt really defeated, right? I felt like I had failed. I was really upset with myself. I think as alcoholics, addicts, we tend to hold ourselves to pretty high standards, and there's no reason why they shouldn't have went as I believed it should have gone, right? So I get out and I call one of my mentors and I said, I'm fucking furious about this. Like, this should have worked. And he said, well, wait a minute. Did you stay sober throughout this process? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, as far as I'm aware of and what you've shared with me, you can't put a price tag on your sobriety. So I believe you won, right? So that was a really like nice answer to an unpleasant result. And then I thought about this kid often. And I'm like, he's probably dead in that park where he resides and that bench that he sleeps on, which is where I know I've went to it millions of times growing up. Didn't hear anything about him from him. 33 days later, I receive a phone call, and it's that kid. And he said to me, he said, hey, I want to apologize to you. I just wasn't at a point in my life where I was ready to fly to a different state to go to rehab. And although I didn't accept your help, I went to treatment the next day locally, and I've been sober ever since. And actually, I have two of my friends here that want and need help. Can you help them? So the guy that I thought was going to die for sure, because it did not go as I thought or believed it should have went, got sober, and then brought two of his friends to me and said, can you help them? Which I ultimately placed into rehab. You know what I mean?
So, that is so cool.
What I believe to be a failure because it doesn't go as I think it should turned out to this really big success. And it just proved to me that, like, when I want to make my God laugh, I tell him how my day is going to go.
And yep.
I'm not in charge of anything. I'm merely just a messenger in a much bigger play. And I played my part, and I did it exactly as I should have. And it worked out exactly as it was supposed to.
That's so cool. That's so cool hearing stuff like that. I'm so glad you guys are out there doing what you're doing right now. And I know we got to wrap up, but I just want to say thank you so much for being on the show and for sharing your stories with us. And I hope at some point, you know, when the lockdown order is not in place, we can all go to a meeting together.
Yeah, we'll disrupt that fucking meeting.
Yes.
If it's okay with you, I always leave, like, whenever I do interviews and stuff, I leave my number available to anyone watching that might be struggling, that they can reach me directly. And if I don't get it, it's not because I'm just ignoring it. It's because I'm only one person and I'm human and I have two phones. If that's okay, the phone number they can reach me at is 610-635-9092. And if you're in a position that you can't find your way out of on your own, please call me and my team and we will do what we can to get you the help that you not only need, but more so deserve.
Cool.
I'll leave mine also. It's 408-701-7321. And even if you don't need an intervention for a family member, and you just need to talk through some things or you need to navigate through treatment facilities, I'm not attached to any treatment facility. So I can help you navigate that through that and help a family find the right spot or an individual.
That's so cool. Thank you guys for being so open and honest. That's real shit right there. Like, really, it's heartwarming. And thank you so much for being on the show. I think this has been great. Yeah.
Thank you, Dana.
I love you all, guys.
Thank you to Vicky Lucas from Equanimity Interventions and for Brandon Novak for being on this show. This was an amazing episode. They were both so forthcoming and great. If you would like their information, it will be in our show notes. If you've never listened to this show and you like what you heard, please like, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes, Squadcast, whatever. Just check us out, like us. We've got over 300 episodes in the bank. If you would like to contact us, the phone number is 415-496-9511. Even if we're not in studio, email radiorehab@gotoproductions.com. That's gotoproductions.com. And on all the socials, it's @RadioRehabDana. Thank you for listening. Keep coming back.